This is the Nichols-Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July the 13th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. We're going to take a look this week at what's happened in the area of federal taxes and some recent developments that may be of interest to you. This week, I'm actually taping this from a hotel room in New York City, so we may be, and I'm using a little bit different equipment, so hopefully things don't seem too different or strange, but we'll take a look and see how things go with this one. So we're going to start out this week taking a look at an issue that arises with regard to late filed tax returns and the issue of whether or not the amounts that were involved could be discharged in bankruptcy. The case in question is Mallow versus United States, 114 AFTR 2nd, 2014-7022 from the Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. The Supreme Court denied certiorari on this case at the end of their most recent session, so the 10th Circuit decision stands now as it was originally issued. What happened in this case was the taxpayer filed a tax return after the due date of the return, actually after being contacted by the IRS. So the taxpayer had a balance due on the tax return. The taxpayer filed the return late, and then the taxpayer eventually went and filed bankruptcy. In this case, the IRS protests that because the return was filed late, that this particular tax is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. The IRS argued that, in fact, under the BAP CPA law, which basically was the Bankruptcy Reform Act, that in essence, a return could only be discharged if it basically complied with all applicable filing requirements. And in this case, the 10th Circuit, agreeing with a case of the 5th Circuit that dealt with the state income tax dischargeability issue, held that one of the requirements to be in compliance with applicable filing requirements for a tax return is that the return has to be filed on time. If the return is not filed on time, then the return is not, after the bankruptcy reform of 2005, dischargeable in bankruptcy. That creates some real issues for clients who have problems and get behind in taxes, because obviously one of the hitches that tends to happen is when people do that, they have a tendency sometimes to stop filing returns when they have financial trouble and they don't want to go ahead and pay the taxes. You know, or they just don't want to be reminded that they can't pay the taxes. This suggests that that's not such a good idea. Certainly, it never was appeared to be a good idea. Now it appears to be a really bad idea. Because though in those cases, this is another circuit agreeing that such a return cannot effectively be discharged. The debt on it cannot be discharged in bankruptcy, no matter how long ago it had been filed. That's not the issue. It's not dischargeable. The next case up is an interesting case. This is a case of Stark versus Commissioner. And Stark versus Commissioner deals with the issue of when, in fact, a balance is owed or when an amount is taxable to the taxpayer. In this particular case, we're going to find out that there's no question that Mr. Stark had income. The IRS basically and the tax court agree they had income. The problem that the IRS is going to have is it turns out the IRS was attempting to assess income in a year that was different from the year in which it should have been assessed based on the facts of the situation. In this case, Mr. Stark was given a credit card that he could use for business purposes. And what he did was he would use the card, and as he made charges on the card, at the end of the month, if he didn't support what was paid in as being business-related for the company would go ahead and treat that amount as an advance, and they would eventually start withholding amounts from his paycheck. Now, this went on for a while. Eventually, what happened was Mr. Stark discovered there was an investigation into the organization. Mr. Stark was a fundraiser, former NFL player, was a fundraiser for this organization, and he began to become concerned. He claimed ethically that he didn't want to be involved with the organization anymore because there were some concerns about his financial management. So he left the organization. He left the organization with a fairly substantial sum remaining on the ledger for the advance account that he had. In this particular case, he ended up with a number that in this case was substantially right around, as I recall the numbers here, $83,698.45, found my number. So he had that much money left on the account. The company issued a 1099 miscellaneous for the unpaid balance when he quit, claiming that essentially they were discharging it, walking away from it, and therefore be taxable in that year. That 1099 miscellaneous was issued for 2010. Now, the tax court went back and looked at the ledger in this case and discovered that all the advances had been paid to Mr. Stark in the year 2003 to 2006. From 2007 on, the only charges against his, the only thing on that ledger were amounts coming out of his paycheck. Now, Mr. Stark apparently didn't pay a whole lot of attention to his paycheck because he said he knew he'd had money coming out, but he thought it related to health insurance or maybe taxes. He wasn't quite sure what. In any event, wasn't quite sure what was there. Now, the problem we've got right now is he taxable on the amount in 2010? And the tax court said, well, what this turns on is whether this was a loan or an advance. If it was a loan to Mr. Stark, then basically it would not be taxable when he received it, but it would only be taxable when it later was determined he would not repay it and be taxable at that point, effectively, normally, as a cancellation of debt. However, if this was not a loan initially, but rather was simply a payment to Mr. Stark for advance payment for services to be rendered in the future, then under the tax law and the code section 61, that's taxable when Mr. Stark is paid. That's back in the years when he got it. Well, the tax court said here, and this was kind of interesting, the IRS actually was claiming in court that it was an advance and not a loan. The court said, well, we agree it's not a loan. To be a loan, there has to be an intent among the parties to actually, that there would be a real repayment, an intent to repay, an intent to collect, as opposed to the thought that it would be repaid simply by the person doing additional services. The court found that all the documentation suggested this was an advance. The IRS claimed it was an advance. As an advance, Mr. Stark should have paid taxes on this in 2003 through 2006. The IRS was litigating this case, claiming trying to assess tax in 2010. The tax court said, sorry, IRS, there is no income in 2010. There's nothing there. We don't care you got the 1099 this year. That's nice, but tough luck. Now, this case is interesting because I have a feeling there's more than a few small companies out there that do things like this, that have a system like this where somebody gets advances or they essentially don't account for everything, and so they charge that off into an account with a running total. And the theory being, well, we're just going to collect that from in the future as they work. If that's the case, remember, in this case, one of the catches is that the employer, in theory, had not paid payroll taxes for those years and had been underreporting the taxes in those years as well. This also means that the employer could find the IRS claiming now, reversing the concept here, that you know what, that $83,000 that you're trying to deduct this year, well, it was properly an expense of the earlier years, so tough luck, taxpayer. This isn't an expense of 2010, and you don't get a deduction for the $83,000 because you should have deducted it many years ago. In this particular case, the organization appears to be a not-for-profit organization, so it probably doesn't care about that. But a for-profit organization could really care about this particular structure and this particular issue. Next up, an issue dealing with defined benefit pension plans. Not a whole lot of those a lot of us deal with, but if you deal with them, they're significant. Notice 2015-49. The IRS issued a notice indicating that they were going to plan to issue regulations to deal with something that they apparently are unhappy with. Some defined benefit plans, when we have an employee who's currently being paid out over their life expectancy on an annuity, are offering those employees the option to take a lump sum payment to pay off the entire rest of the balances due to them. They take the position that that's actually an increase in payment or increase in benefit, which allows them to change the payment structure under the required minimum distribution rules applicable to a defined benefit pension plan. Now remember, this is for plans and for people that are already in pay status. That is, they had already received or they were already receiving, you know, they'd already received their payouts. They were getting their payouts for life. Now the company's simply trying to buy them out. The IRS is not thrilled with that option. The IRS intends to amend regulations to block this, and the amendments will be effective for any payments made after July 9th of 2015, which was the date this notice was issued. That means basically from this point on, the regulations, you've been put warnings that the regulations are going to say, if you do this now, you've just caused problems with your plan. However, the service realized that some people have already done this and are, you know, may have legitimately worked it on. So they do allow some basically exceptions. They say the regulations plan to allow an exception if the amendment creating the option was adopted or specifically authorized by a board committee or similar body with authority to amend the plan prior to the July 9th date. A plan is one that has a private letter ruling determination letter that was issued by the IRS prior to July 9th. A program with respect to which a written communication to affected plans participants stating an explicit and definite intent to implement the lump sum risk transferring program was received by the participants prior to that July 9th date, or a program adopted pursuant to an agreement between the plan sponsor and employee representative, that is, in a collective bargaining agreement, specifically authorizing implementation of such a program that was entered into and was binding prior to July 9th. If you have a program that meets one of those four requirements, the program is going to essentially, for this particular case, be called a pre-notice acceleration that will be exempted from the regs, at least the IRS believes so when they finally write the regs. What you'll need to watch for here is if you have a program like this, you want to make sure you meet one of those four requirements. If you don't have one, but you're thinking of adopting one, then you probably need to hold up for right now. And you're also going to need to keep an eye on what the service actually does. This is merely an announcement that we're going to propose regulations, which some point we'll adopt. So this is like a warning that the service is going to say we're doing this. Now, when the service does this, there's a really, really good chance they're going to go forward with it. Because the service, when they make these announcements, that's intentionally putting a line in the sand, realizing we can't get the regs out real quick. They don't want to get the regs out right now because they don't want to rush them. But they want to tell everybody that we're going to block this thing, so they put a date out there. So I suspect it's highly likely that whatever they do will have a July 9th date, and they will effectively want to shut this down. So just be aware of that if you're advising individuals or advising companies that sponsor defined benefit plans that have been attempting to do these risk transfer programs, this may become a problem. Next up, we've got yet another passive activity loss real estate professional case. This is a case of Padilla versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-38. Now, this particular case is a little bit interesting because Mr. Padilla in this case actually didn't have some of the problems that a lot of the taxpayers before that have lost have had in this area. Now, Mr. Padilla, like some other taxpayers in this area, did have another job, and that job was not related to real estate. But Mr. Padilla in the year in question had been laid off early in the year. So he only had 676 hours in the job. Nobody is disputing that. So that was his total hours in the job. Mr. Padilla, many taxpayers in this case have been tripped up because they didn't have any reasonable log or documentation or explanation of the time they had spent on the rental properties. Mr. Padilla had a log of 764 hours that he claimed were spent in real estate. So he said, you know, I've got this. So I've got 764 hours in real estate. It's over half of my personal services in activities in which I materially participate. Therefore, I'm a real estate professional. Now, the problem he ran into, though, was what made up the 764 hours. And in this case, the problem became that the court said most of the hours for each month were in generic categories of researching properties near properties already owned, refinancing the properties, foreclosure research, which appears to be considering properties that could be purchased, and researching new businesses. He had hired a management company to manage the Fort Texas property, and he had a real estate company to find tenants and lease the San Francisco property. What the court found was his activities in this case were far more like an investor. And under the regulation 1.469-5T, generally, activities of an individual of the nature of an investor do not count toward hours of material participation. And once you take those hours off his list, it turns out Mr. Padilla's not going to be able to qualify as a real estate professional. So Mr. Padilla ended up losing that position and ended up with a bit of a problem, shall we say. What that reminds us of is some of the problems we've got to check here for real estate pros. tells us, A, as I've mentioned before, the IRS clearly is examining returns that claim Real Estate Pro and has been looking specifically at passive activities. We've seen way too many cases on this. Remember, cases do not come unless there's been exams. And when you see a bunch of cases, that tells you there's a bunch of exams. So the IRS is clearly looking for this. Number two, remember all the little detailed rules in the passive activity area. This is one of those things that probably years ago when you took a course on passive activities, you remember it was mentioned that activities as an investor don't count. Well, the problem is if you haven't updated yourself in a while, you might have forgotten that little detail. And if you're assisting a client, you might end up not considering whether the hours in question are going to look like investor hours or are they going to look like somebody who's actively involved in the property. In this case, there were issues. Also, please remember that this individual would have probably been in trouble and just not even gotten this far had he not been laid off. The fact he was laid off was the only reason he was able to meet the first test, because otherwise, had he essentially, at the rate we were going here, worked another month or two, he would have had more hours in his other job than real estate, because as the court pointed out, part of the reason he got 764 hours in real estate was because he was laid off. He couldn't find another job, so he spent more time in real estate than he had in the past. Next up, we're going to talk about an issue here about organizations, and this is the case of the descendants of Hungarian immigrants in the Performing Arts Inc. versus the United States, 2015 TNT 128-15. This particular case takes a look at a supposedly tax-exempt organization. And what it tells us is one of the things that we have, if something looks too good to be true as normal, it's probably too good to be true. In essence, if it smells bad, we've got a problem. And it turns out this thing smells bad. In this particular case, a gentleman passed away. The gentleman had immigrated to the U.S. from Hungary. And so he passed away and had a taxable estate. What he did with his estate was took enough funds from the estate and gave it to formed an organization, which is the one in question, the Descendants of Hungarian Immigrants in the Performing Arts Inc., which was going to provide scholarships to immigrants, to basically descendants of immigrants from Hungary who were studying in the performing arts. So, and they went with this issue. So they went and got went to the IRS, asked to get approved as a tax-exempt org. They filed the application. They went through the process. They answered the IRS's questions in the back and forth. And they were eventually granted tentatively that they were a tax-exempt organization allowed to operate. Now, the key issue here, when the IRS does that, they're looking at your form. So we're looking at whether or not you as an organization have a stated purpose. But in order to remain a tax-exempt organization, you must also be operated for a public purpose, not merely formed for it. In operation, this particular organization gave two sets of scholarships that we're looking at here. In the first set, they gave to two individuals, both of whom were descendants of the decedent. And then the following year, they gave three scholarships. They renewed the two for the ones who they had previously given the scholarships to, and they gave another one to another descendant of this individual. The IRS examined the organization and said, wait, this is being run for private benefit. The organization said, but wait a second, the IRS had approved it. And, they'd approved the organization. And these individuals are clearly studying the performing arts, and they're a descendant of a Hungarian immigrant. So they meet all of our requirements. The court said, tough luck. You've got to operate for an exempt purpose. Now, the court noted that by itself is a problem, that you merely gave it to relatives. That operation starts looking like a private purpose, not a public purpose. So it's probably dead then. Didn't help either that the IRS had specifically asked them about how they're going to advertise this. They claimed they were going to put ads in a newspapers of public circulation. They named specifically USA Today and a newspaper that goes to the Hungarian community. Neither one of those newspapers ever carried the ad. In fact, no other newspaper did. They claimed they would also advertise on the internet. Well, they did that, but they actually only did it the day after the service started the exam. So the judge says, look, you lied to the service about this because the service specifically asked you about how you're going to publicize this. They also ask you about how you're going to award the scholarships. You claim there'd be a panel of three independent persons who'd run it. But it turned out that the actual meetings where these were awarded, not two of your three experts never attended. And the one who did attend was also a beneficiary of the fund and didn't really select people for the scholarship. She merely approved people to make sure the ones that they had wanted, you know, appeared to meet the basic criteria, but she didn't actually get involved in selecting. So the court said you'd also lied to the IRS about that. And because of that, the IRS is fully justified in retroactively revoking the tax-exempt status of the organization. Again, if it smells, and it should be obvious to most anybody that this smelled from the start, there's a good chance it's simply not going to work. This has been the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July the 13th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you each week to talk to you about what's going to go on in the area of federal taxes. Our website online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com has links to the actual details in each of these, including the source documents, gives additional write-up describing the issues in these cases, and if you check in there during the week, as developments happen during the week and we get time to write them up, we'll write up the developments during the week so you can try to keep up with things there. Be sure to join us next week as we again take a look at the developments in the area of federal taxes.